Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the problems facing Boeing after failures of its Starliner spacecraft have left two astronauts stranded in space. They were supposed to be on the International Space Station for 8 days, but will now be there for at least 8 months. This is the latest in a long line of crises facing the company. So is this one failure too far for Boeing? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report on the BBC World Service. Will Bain with you today as we kick off another business week. Great, as always, to have your company. Coming up on the programme today, in just a moment, we'll be hearing from the Israeli businessman encouraging his staff to protest.
Those who want to participate in protest, I have encouraged them to take the day off. We pay them and we're happy to have them protest.
Also on the programme today, Thailand's war on what it calls an alien fish that it fears could cost its economy almost $300 million.
Because vaccine therapies, they eat many different kinds of food that could have tremendous effects to the ecosystem.
Yeah, more on the black chin tilapia a little bit later on in the programme. And also today, a ticketing meltdown, cries of foul play, as fans of the band Oasis come face to face with one of business's hottest trends, dynamic pricing. If you've not heard about it before, we'll be explaining all before we leave you today on World Business Report. We're going to start, though, in Israel after a night and day of nationwide protests. The sound of people chanting on the streets of Tel Aviv, demanding the government double down on efforts to free the remaining hostages taken after Hamas's attack last October. What started with protests has evolved into sporadic strikes across the country on Monday, with roads blocked, some schools closing and government departments shut as well. Earlier, a spokesman for the main trade union group told the BBC it was the right course of action to put pressure on the government to get the hostages home. Peter Lerner is the spokesman for the Histadrut union who called the strike.
The damage to Israel's economy, to the workers of Israel, the concerns that we have with political influences in the negotiation process, and the need for unity, not division in our society, and the requirements to restore the safety and security to people of Israel and the internally displaced people here in Israel required a general strike.
Flights at the main Ben Gurion International Airport were disrupted for many hours. These passengers, whose flights were delayed, say the strike was the right action.
On our way to Greece for a one-week holiday, unfortunately, our flight has been delayed due to the changes of the strike today. Having said that, I've participated in the big event last night for the hostages, and for me, the cause justify the impact on me.
The strike is undoubtedly justified. Yesterday evening, we were happy that we could go on vacation after such a difficult year. But when we saw the head of the Histadrut union is calling for the strike, we said, whatever happens, the hostages come first.
Well, in the past few hours, a Labour court has ruled that the strike was political and workers were ordered back to work this afternoon. Doesn't seem to have stopped the disruption so far, though. Fleur Hassan Nahum is a special envoy for the Israeli Foreign Ministry. She says it's a mistake to blame the Israeli leadership for the failure to reach a deal with Hamas, a deal which could have prevented the strikes.
The erroneous assumption is that somehow it's Israel that is fully responsible for holding back a deal. I don't believe that, actually. Hamas has been offered a deal 5-6 times, and each time they've found excuses not to make the deal. And it's not me saying it, it's Antony Blinken saying it, who's been intimately involved in the details of the deals from the beginning. I don't believe Hamas really wants a deal. If they wanted a deal, why did they go and execute 6 innocent hostages yesterday?
Well, in the last couple of minutes, coming down on the wires from the White House, President Biden answering questions from reporters saying he doesn't feel that the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has done enough in pushing for that ceasefire deal. What about businesses, though, in Israel? What kind of disruption have they faced so far today? Ofer Doron is the founder and chief executive of the Israeli EV engine startup EVR Motors. They're based in the Tel Aviv suburbs.
I've encouraged my workers to go and protest, but not all are protesters. So those that aren't protesting work, and those who want to participate in protest, I've encouraged them to take the day off. We pay them, and we're happy to have them protest.
Right. So you're still open, still working as a company, but encouraging any staff who want to go and protest.
Exactly. Exactly. But many other companies are closed. Much of the government is closed. The airport's barely working. The trains and buses are working only partially. There are a lot of roadblocks by the protesters in many different areas, often by surprise.
Why have you made that decision? Why have you encouraged your staff to protest?
Because the future of our country depends on ridding us of our very radical government. And specifically at this stage, the strategy of our prime minister to lengthen the war just so he can stay in power. And so his court problems get delayed and delayed because he's standing trial for bribery. All of that is causing awful decisions. And the last one being to ruin any chance of a hostage exchange or a hostage deal with Hamas, which is basically stop the fighting in Gaza and getting back all the hostages.
He would argue, of course, that that's precisely what he's trying to do, is get these hostages out, dealing with what's not always been a trustworthy partner in those negotiations, would be his argument.
They're not trustworthy. They are criminal, terrorist, murderers, totally inhumane. I could never in my life say a single good thing about how they are behaving. The question is one of strategy. What is more important? Have we done enough now in Gaza so that the threat there is significantly reduced? And what is now more important? And more important is to get the hundreds of thousands of people who are out of their homes in the north and the south back. It's to get the hostages back. It's to rebuild the country and the economy, which have taken a hit.
You've spoken to us before kindly on the program offer about the economic backdrop, you know, more difficult for you're seeing fewer people come to visit you to inquire about new inquiries for business, that kind of stuff. Does a massive nationwide strike, well-meaning as the reasons might be, not exacerbate what's already a pretty difficult economic situation?
In the very, very short term, yes. But the government is spending huge amounts of money on the wrong things. And if we don't put a stop to it, the economy, we see this in the credit ratings that are going down. We see this in the huge deficit that is not only the result of the military operations. We see this in problems with investments. We see this across the board. And so the only real solution is to put in place a government that will run the economy the right way. And it's not this government, unfortunately.
Have you continued to see that chilling effect on investment?
Absolutely. It goes up and down. Visits are down because flights have been cancelled again after the last threats from Iran and Lebanon.
How much pressure is that putting on your business?
It's putting pressure on the business. It took me 20 hours to fly to India instead of a six-hour direct flight that's been cancelled a few weeks ago. So I pay a bit of a toll. My staff pays a bit of a toll. Not always optimal, but we manage.
If the protests continue, your support for your staff is what, limitless? You'll continue to allow them until these protests end? And will you yourself potentially join one of these protests?
I'm very active in protests. I was out protesting last night till well past midnight with my two sons blocking one of the major highways in Tel Aviv. We are protesting tonight. We'll continue protesting for a long time, I presume, until it works.
Ofer Doron there from EVR Motors in Tel Aviv. Well, let's zoom out and look at the Israeli economy more broadly and the impact not just of this strike, perhaps, but also that almost, what, a year of conflict now. Michael Ben-Gad is with us to do just that. He's Professor of Economics at the City St. George's University of London. Professor, thanks for being with us on World Business Report.
Hello.
We heard the trade union talking about exactly that in the clip we played there, the damage already done to the Israeli economy by, what, nearly a year of conflict.
Well, I would just reinforce, the conflict is estimated to cost about 250 billion shekels, about $70 billion. That's both, half of that is a direct cost from military expenditure, and half indirect. The larger question is how the government is actually handling these things. There's been one downgrade in the credit rating already. Now, what the government claims is that this is all due to the war. But if you actually read the reports, what they're saying is that that's not the case. Israel has faced military conflicts in the past and has managed to deal with them. The larger question is the fiscal stance of the government. And this government is very much enthralled to a lot of very narrow sectoral interests, and that's where a lot of the spending goes. There are 32 different ministries, and about half of them are basically just patronage factories.
Right.
So, yes.
Well, contextualize what's going on today. Obviously, as we speak, very fluid situation about what impact these strikes are having. But can you see already how significant or unsignificant the economic impact might be if this is to roll for what, days, weeks?
No, it's all going to happen. The court has said what it has said. I don't see the head of the Histadrut, that's the Labor Federation, defying a court order. The argument of the court was that this is basically a political strike, which I think is true. And so as of 2:30, he was only talking about doing this till 6. So either way, tomorrow, everybody, all of this ends, at least in the public sector. The private sector, it's hard to imagine that they would carry on doing this. It's meant to be symbolic. It's meant to send a message to the government. The more likely outcome is that this in itself is not going to bring down the government. Right now, the Knesset, the parliament, is not in session. It only resumes on the 27th of October. At that point, it remains to be seen what happens. This is a very fractious coalition.
And there's a budget to get through at that point, right, as well?
Excuse me?
And there's a budget to get through at that point when parliament does reconvene.
Right. So this is where things get more serious for the government, because legally the government is required to pass a budget by the end of the year, in theory. In practice, they have a 3-month grace period till the end of March. Under normal circumstances, the budget would have been already discussed and all the negotiations would be nearly finished. And when the Knesset goes back into session, they would be ready to vote, do a first reading on the budget. In practice, or this time, nothing has been done. There have been virtually no meetings. There certainly have not been any meetings with the economists who work inside the Ministry of Finance. And that's because of the Minister of Finance himself, Bezalel Smotrich, who's kind of at war with the economists within his own ministry. He sees himself as a kind of a visionary. Mm. He opposes all sorts of things that they've been recommending. I mean, to be quite frank, he's a bit at war with all sorts of eccentric things like basic arithmetic, and that's a serious problem. The governor of the Bank of Israel is a very, very diplomatic person and is trying to sort of nudge the government to behave responsibly. He's becoming more and more outspoken over time, warning them that they need to start changing their behavior.
Sure, we'll speak to you again before that pinch point later on in the autumn, Professor. Professor Michael Ben-Gad, there, Professor of Economics at City St. George's University, speaking to us there on the latest situation about the economy in Israel. You're with World Business Report on the BBC.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the problems facing Boeing after failures of its Starliner spacecraft have left two astronauts stranded in space. They were supposed to be on the International Space Station for 8 days, but will now be there for at least 8 months. This is the latest in a long line of crises facing the company. So is this one failure too far for Boeing? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
World Service. One analyst told us recently there's a China-sized hole in almost all major companies' financial results right now. The Chinese economy has remained worryingly sluggish through 2024 and continues to be racked by trouble, particularly in its property sector. That was illustrated again today as shares in many of the region's biggest property developers fell, and the country also announced falling factory data. Zelina Zhang is head of East Asia Corporate and Asia Strategy at Credit Sites, a company based in Singapore. Zelina, thanks for being with us on World Business Report.
Thanks for having me here.
Let's start with the property sector again, because this was a major developer in Hong Kong this time with a pretty serious financial warning.
Sort of one in itself was not really a surprise. Newer Development has huge exposure to China. They have development projects as well as commercial properties in China. And interestingly, actually the China business is doing a bit better there than their Hong Kong business. And I think we also know in Hong Kong, the residential market is facing a lot of headwinds because of the expats are leaving. A lot of the multinational corporates are also leaving. And right now, the retail sales are also slowing down a little bit. So that resulted in some impairment losses regarding the revaluation of their properties.
Yeah, you paint a pretty vicious circle there, Zelina. Can you get to the bottom of which is driving the other? You know, which is solvable, I suppose, which is the most pressing to try and stop impacting the others?
I think right now, the contagion risk is actually not so material, which is a good thing. I think the equity market is facing a lot of headwinds, especially for the property sector. But if you look at the dollar bonds of the investment grade property developers in Hong Kong and in China, they're still relatively resilient. And I think overall, the economy is still growing. Maybe it is below the market expectation, but we are not talking about drastic derailing of the Chinese or Hong Kong economy. So that is setting some floor to the, at least the bond prices of these property segments.
And what about that PMI data today? What did you take away from that? That's sort of what people are buying basically in these countries, in these companies, these future orders.
Yeah, I think the government is citing some seasonality reasons because the weather was pretty bad in August and as well as July. But if you look into the details, property is still a driving force behind the weak reading. The other factor is the fiscal stimulus. It feels like a below market expectation despite all the special local government bond that they pushed out year to date. It feels like the implementation has been less effective than the number are indicating. So overall, it's not a surprise, but I think the Caixin PMI's weakness is a little bit of surprise because this index is more export oriented. And year to date, China's export has been very strong, but it feels like we're seeing some cracking in the data as well.
Zelina, thanks so much for your insight there. Zelina Zeng, head of East Asia Corporates and Asia Strategy at Credit Sites in Singapore. Jane Sydenham with us, Investment Director at Rathbones Investment Management, to look at what else is moving financial markets today. But Jane, just give us a quick thought on that. On those sort of two China stories, I guess.
I mean, China is an important part of the world economy. And I guess what we need to remember is that in 2009, when the world went into a terrible recession after the financial crisis, China kind of took the rest of the world out of it. And that was really through sort of demand for all kinds of goods and particularly actually infrastructure. But this time around, you know, the confidence that's been knocked through the downturn in the property sector is actually affecting Western companies in a different way. So demand for, you know, luxury goods, spirits, European particularly, luxury cars, and the auction houses are having a difficult time. You know, a lot of that spending that was coming through before is now much weaker than in the past.
And we're seeing that come through today. Volkswagen, for example, warning potentially that it might be slowing down some production coming up. Elsewhere, Jane, perhaps a bit closer to home for you here on the looking at the London markets, Rightmove, which is a big property website, a estate agent website here in the UK, looks like it might be being bought out by an Australian company, sorry.
No, interesting. I mean, the shares are up 24-25% today on the possibility of an offer from the company, from this company called REA. They don't have to actually make a decision until the end of the month, but you know, it would be sort of £4-4.5 billion of in terms of a bid if were they to actually make one. I mean, what's interesting about this is that the competition in the UK sort of advertising or property advertising market is intensifying. There's an American company called CoStar who bought a company called On The Market recently. And so they're taking the fight to Rightmove. So it'd be very interesting if REA decide to step in. Yeah. They have a very different business model in Australia, which is much more advertising oriented rather than a technology platform. So, you know, interesting stuff. We'll have to wait and see whether they do decide to launch a bid, but certainly having an impact today.
An interesting battle in online estate agency, isn't it? Jane Sydenham of Rathbones, thank you very much for your time. You're with World Business Report on the BBC World Service. Sounds like something from a sci-fi film, doesn't it? An invasive species. Authorities in Thailand have dubbed an alien fish, though, unfortunately, very much a reality and pressing from a business perspective, an economic one too, could be enormously costly to the country's key shellfish and fishing industries. Something this 66-year-old fish farmer from a fishing village in Thailand knows all too well about.
I used to farm shrimp, crabs and fish in semi-wild farm. I've been doing it for 40 years, since 1978. We had never seen this black-chin tilapia fish at all until 2012. We thought they were bizarre and thought they would go away, but we saw more and more of them. I had to change my career because of them. I switched to do restaurants. A lot of farmers changed their careers as well. All of us are struggling since the black-chin tilapia outbreak.
Well, for more on the black-chin tilapia, we spoke to Shachana Chavanich. She's Professor of Marine Biology at Chulalongkorn University in Bangkok.
Black-chin tilapia is not native to Thailand. It has been introduced from Africa about 14 years ago for the aquaculture purpose, just for the experiments. And then later on, it has been for more than 3 or 4 years already that the fishermen have been complaining about the effects of the black-chin tilapia, because black-chin tilapia, they eat many different kinds of food, including the fish, the shrimps, small one, big one, and that could have tremendous effects to the ecosystem, particularly to the fishermen who have to go out and collect all those economically fish or the crab and shrimp and so on.
So fish that they would normally catch and sell are being eaten.
Yes, right.
And so now the government is paying people, what, 40 US cents a kilo to try and catch these things?
Mm-hmm. They think that this is the way to reduce the population of the black-chin tilapia, but tell you the truth, one invasive species have been invaded to a certain area, it's going to be hard to eradicate all those populations into the zero.
And so does it have any natural predators too that could help?
Unfortunately, in Thailand, we don't really have predators that prey on it. But the government have been trying to introduce another fish that can be able to kill or eat this black-chin tilapia. But so far, we're not really sure about this.
Until then, it could have a massive impact on those fishermen, those people who make a livelihood from fishing the other fish that this tilapia is guzzling down.
Yeah, one thing that I would like to point out is that in Thailand, this black-chin tilapia is not the first invasive species that came to Thailand. We have so many invasive species in Thailand already before the black-chin tilapia. And many of them have been already spread into many, many places in Thailand. But for this case, I think because people think that black-chin tilapia doesn't really have economical value, that's why they try to eradicate it. If you come to Thailand, most people like to eat the shrimp. But not many people realize that the shrimp that we have in Thailand right now is also an introduced species. It's a white shrimp. It has been introduced from South America. We used to have the native shrimps, but right now, most introduced white shrimps. And for this case, people don't mind if this introduced white shrimp will escape into the river, into the oceans. And the reason, because they think that this white shrimp have some economical value.
One rule for something that makes money, another rule for something that doesn't.
Right, correct.
Professor Shachana Chavanich there, speaking to us from Bangkok, Thailand. Now, been widespread criticism of a process known as dynamic pricing. It's in everything, trains, hotels, Ubers even. But this weekend, it impacted the reunion tour of the rock group Oasis. Shelley and Horn, competition economist at the accounting firm Grant Thornton, explain more.
basically where price goes up or goes down in order to match demand and supply. So if supply of a product goes up or demand for a product goes up, the price will change. So, and we do see it. And I guess even to some extent, we do see it for sort of, you know, concerts and in the UK. So for example, you have a venue and a venue is quite empty and you want to get more people in, you might distribute tickets via another way. You might give them away for free. You might give them as competition prizes. You might sell them through a sort of discount channel. It just won't be done so obviously. And typically it's sort of, certainly in the UK, it's been done to maybe fill venues where maybe you haven't been able to sell out.
And is that the issue here, do you think?
Yeah.
That this hasn't been signposted as well as it could have been?
It hasn't been signposted. And I think, you know, the band made a big deal about hyping up these concerts. They hyped it up. There was an awful lot of demand. And as I said, you know, people have been waiting for, you know, 5, 6, whatever hours in these websites, in this queue. You suddenly get to the front. You've agreed with your mates what you're going to pay for the ticket, what your maximum price is. You know what you've got to spend on it, you know, what your limit on your credit card is, all of those things. And then suddenly you get your tickets in the basket and they're not what you're expecting. And you have 5 minutes to make that decision.
Yeah, and there's pressure put on that decision as well.
Exactly. There's a lot of pressure. And, you know, my understanding is Ticketmaster did say that it was market pricing, and it wouldn't have been Ticketmaster, by the way, that decided this thing. But, you know, I was asked earlier, you're an economist. Did you know? And I was like, no, I didn't know. And I didn't read the terms and conditions. And I'm sure it was there. And I'm, you know, maybe I should have known.
And the UK government has now said, oh, it's going to look at this. Is there actually much that governments and regulators actually can do? As you say, this is bedded into all sorts of things, everything from flights to trains to Ubers to all sorts of things that we take now.
I think it's a really hard problem. I think, first of all, it's not really about accessibility. So if this is about how you get tickets to those fans, those sort of diehard fans, there are other ways to do it. And we see that from, you know, the Chelsea Flower Show to Wimbledon tennis to other sports events. So if you want to get tickets to those diehard fans, dynamic pricing doesn't really come into it. It's not about that. One of the reasons maybe dynamic pricing was used is that if you sell a ticket for basically below what people are willing to pay and it's then resold on, what happens is the resellers basically get that extra revenue. Instead, here, by trying to match demand and supply more and getting the price to do that, what you see is that higher ticket price flowing back to Oasis, their management, you know, maybe the venue, who knows, but that side of the supply chain. So what it's trying to do is basically reallocate the revenue, you know, the upside revenue away from the sort of any resellers essentially and back to the sort of the venues, so that, you know, Oasis, etc. I think it's very hard for the government to try and regulate this. If you start trying to, you know, regulate ticket prices, then potentially you end up with sort of more black market reselling, you know, more people exchanging on sort of Facebook, etc. But so I think the key here is it really is a consumer protection issue. So it's really about customers understanding what they're paying for, you know, what they're buying, that you're not getting this sort of premium service because you're paying more, you're getting a sort of regular ticket, and that the ticket price can go up, it can go down in line with demand, and just making people aware of that at the point they sort of join these queues, at the point they agree with their mates what they're going to pay for tickets, just making sure people are aware of it.
Skelly and Horn there, the competition economist at the firm Grant Thornton, bringing us just about to the end of this edition of World Business Report.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at the problems facing Boeing after failures of its Starliner spacecraft have left two astronauts stranded in space. They were supposed to be on the International Space Station for 8 days, but will now be there for at least 8 months. This is the latest in a long line of crises facing the company. So is this one failure too far for Boeing? Find us wherever you get your podcasts.